Tonight on Arena, Maya Brennan and Leisha Kelly on TG Cahir's Ciol Ó Cailmore, and Sue Rainsford on her story Shorn, which is part of the Spoken Stories series. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Ciol Ó Cailmore, Ciolúir an na Mban, is a special show from Cailmore Abbey celebrating women in traditional music, and it will be broadcast on TG Cahir on Sunday, the eve of St. Bridget's Day. The event was recorded at Cailmore back in December, and joining me this evening will be two of those involved, Donegal woman Moya Brennan and Mayo native Leisha Kelly. But before we talk to Moya and Leisha, let's have a listen, a sample of some of the music involved. This is a series of tunes called Phyllis's Birthday. I just wanted to sample that wonderful first tune there from Phyllis's Birthday, a composition from Josephine Marsh, who is part of TG Cahir's celebration of St. Bridget's Day. It's going out on Sunday evening, the eve of St. Bridget's Day, on TG Cahir, a programme called Ciolúir an na Mban, special show from Cailmore Abbey. And as I said, Donegal woman Moya Brennan, Mayo native Leisha Kelly, both there in December last for the recording of this particular programme. And Leisha, purely because geographically Achill is a little bit closer to Cailmore more than Moya is in Donegal. How would you describe the setting for this concert? I mean, all I think of is the John Hine postcard. It's just emblazoned on my mind, but it's quite a building, quite a place, isn't it?
Oh, it's stunning. Yeah. And even like the drive down is absolutely beautiful. Going up through Westport and going down, you know, the Killary, it's just absolutely stunning, especially this time of year with the lovely colours in the in the heather and the kind of burnty rust colour. And yeah, it's stunning at the minute.
And the actual abbey itself then, Moya, where you rehearse, sounds like they have it all down in Mayo and Galway. There must be nothing left up in Donegal at all.
We have plenty up in Donegal, but I have to say, would you believe, I was ashamed to say I had never been there before. And it certainly won't be my last time because, you know, I didn't get a proper chance to have a look all around. But it's absolutely, as Leisha said, it just amazing, and where it's situated as well. But we were in the recording in the little church there. Mm. And what a setting. It's just, it really is. It's amazing. It's an amazing place. And it was kind of, there's still Benedictine nuns that are still part of it. But it's kind of a cultural place now that's used for various things. And I really certainly will be back there.
Yeah, I've never visited myself, but all I know is that John Hine postcard. But it's just such an amazing picture that I'm sure it's emblazoned on a whole, several generations of Irish people. It must be emblazoned on their minds. And that church surrounding, I suppose, brought a certain intimacy to proceedings, Leisha. And you were in the mix, certainly, there in that tune that we heard at the beginning of that set, Phyllis's Birthday, the music of Josephine Marsh.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to be back with Jo. She was, we had a great time this time last year in the build up to the Gradham Ciol, and she was commissioned to write a tune. It wasn't that particular tune. That was an interpretation that Jackie Daly did of that slow air. And that's Jo now. She'll pick up on that, like, very inventive, you know. But it was lovely. You could hear Sharon as well, Sharon Howley on the cello. She's very, she does deadly funky stuff.
Yeah, it was a real, it really was the women of traditional and I suppose all styles of music that were there, Maya. I'd say wonderful to be part of a gathering like that.
Oh, listen, it was astonishing. And just, you know, I now came on the second day, but I still met up with Leisha and Josephine and Claire Freel and a couple of the girls and Kathy Jordan and that. And it was just gorgeous. I mean, it was gorgeous to be part of such a beautiful show, which I know is going out on Sunday night. And it's just what a lovely opportunity to do something like this, you know, Killaroo na Mann, and especially on the day, the 1st of February, which is like when I grew up in Donegal, the 1st of February was looked upon as kind of the first day of spring kind of thing. But I remember my grandparents used to do it first, but then my father religiously every year would do the Crossa Dríge. And he'd do loads of them so that there would be one nearly in every room, and he'd give some away. And, you know, even before he passed away, you know, a couple of years before that, he'd still be doing them and would give us one for that year. It was really special. It was really special. It was very wholesome and a very, very reassuring kind of thing to have in your house and kind of represented something, you know. And it's just like, you know, St. Bridget, she was an amazing woman, you know, really amazing woman. And, you know, there's a lot of amazing women in Ireland, and it's great to be able to have the opportunity to look upon that, you know.
What about, I mean, that whole idea of the making of the St. Bridget's Cross, is it a dying tradition now? I'm wondering, have you any traditions like that around St. Bridget's Day in particular, Alicia?
Yeah, well, I grew up with that the same as most people everywhere, you know, going out and picking the rushes. And I think this year particularly, I think it'd be a great opportunity. People should embrace that this year and go out. And it's not rocket science how to make it, you know. And if you're, like, say, in the city and you can't get out to get the rushes, you can always, there was another tradition that you would hang out a piece of cloth, like a white piece of cloth, onto a branch somewhere and give it a blessing. And during the night then, Bridget is supposed to have blessed the cloth, and you take it with you, and that was revered in the house then, and taken down for it's kind of quite pagan, actually, really, that you would look upon it for as a something to help, you know, if somebody was sick or the animals,
a kind of a healing thing, really. You know, it was regarded as a kind of little healing cloth, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. There's a kind of this time of year, like this kind of cleaning out and. Yeah, it's great celebration.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's the whole spring clean thing is this time of year, isn't it? And we are looking for moments of hope and light to bring into our lives. And St. Bridget's Day is very much that first day of spring is a way of doing that. I don't want an argument now about when spring actually starts. Let's just agree that February the 1st is a good day to mark the beginning of something, if nothing other than the end of January. Were the mummers ever around on St. Bridget's Day? Was that a tradition associated with that this time of year, Maya?
The mummers for me were either at Halloween and Christmas. Never around this time of year. It was more to do with just the beginning of a new year, and the winter was over and that kind of thing. And, you know, the seasons have changed a bit, but years ago it really was the beginning of spring. You know, now we have snow, you know, coming in February. Yeah. You know, it's the seasons, as I said, have changed. But yeah, no, it was, the mummers weren't around for me anyway. I don't know about you, Leisha.
No, I don't recall that growing up now with the Straw Boys, as you were saying, Christmas time and celebrations. But this is one of the Celtic, the big four, one of the four Celtic occasions of the year. So it is a time to, we should all try and acknowledge it in some way for ourselves. Mm.
All right, yeah. We're going to finish up with another song from Sunday night's program, Maya, and it's you that's a kind of one show. Kadeshin Dantashin, tell us a little bit about this, Aaron.
Well, it's a song that one of the many songs that I grew up with singing in Donegal, and it's really, I'm singing it with my daughter Aisling and harp and guitar, and it's just, it really what it means is, you know, it's nobody's business but my own. And maybe that's for standing up for the girls.
You know? Okay. That's me told off. Well, listen, Gajasvek and Glaritas and Birch live in Oak. Great to speak to the both of you.
And Agus
Ganari live. And that. Let's go to the track, and I'll give you the full details of where you can hear Alicia and Maya and a whole host of other artists just after we hear this. Kadeshin Dantashin. Kadeshin Dantashin, basically mind your own business, as Maya Brennan just explained to us there. And that's Maya Brennan and Alicia Kelly also speaking to us there about Ceol Ó Cailmore, Killer and the Man. It'll be broadcast on TG Cahir Sunday night at 7:30. Spoken Stories is a new 12-part series of short fiction going out every Sunday evening at the moment on RTE Radio 1. The stories are original commissions, inspired by the theme of independence and intended to mark Ireland's decade of centenaries. Works by Anne Enright, Mary Costello and Kevin Barry have already aired. And this Sunday, it's the turn of Sue Rainsford and her story, Shorn, which is read by Saoirse Ronan. And Sue Rainsford joins me now from Harare, Zimbabwe. Before we get into the story, I obviously have to ask you, what are you doing in Zimbabwe, Sue?
Well, my partner is from here, so we generally come out here a couple of months every year. But obviously, with COVID, a lot of postponed and cancelled plans, so we're making up for lost time now.
So you've been there a couple of months, and I suppose you'll be staying put for the foreseeable until restrictions lift?
Yeah, well, we're here. We'll have been here by the time we leave. I think we'll have been here for 2 months all told. But all things going to plan, we are meant to be getting married in a registry office in March. So we have to be back for that. But it's a real pleasure being here. Full lockdown here as well. But it's summer, which
right.
helps.
Yeah, summer. It's not summer. Although I believe you did miss the idea that we had a little bit of the old schnock the last week.
No, the FOMO was extreme. Yeah, no, when I saw the schnock to taking over Twitter, I was like, typical, as soon as I'm not there.
Anyway, let us talk about this story of yours, Shorn, at the tale of a woman who asks her daughters to cut off her hair when she dies and to take it back to the place where she was born. Now, that's in the opening page. That opening sequence where it's the daughter who's narrating the story for us, she tells us that the mother asks her to do this. It's quite an arresting thought that a mother would ask a daughter to do that.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, you know, seeing as the story is about an instance of forced cutting during the Irish Civil War, I wanted to try and build up, you know, this sense of hair, female hair especially, as a site of intimacy and affection and a way of performing care for another person, especially, you know, between women and mothers and daughters and sisters. So, yeah, I kind of wanted to build up that sense of hair as a site of intimacy before subverting it later in the story with the kind of, with the violent attack itself.
Yes, because that opening section is a lovely thought. It's kind of, it struck me, it's like spreading the ashes of a person maybe in a loved place. But as we find, as you say, as the story goes on, the mother is retelling tales of a pastime and haircutting that was perhaps not so intimate and certainly not so peaceful. When you were given that word or that theme of independence as an idea around the story, what did that word conjure up in your mind?
Yeah, you know, I think it's such an interesting thing, this practice of centenaries and commemoration. So I want to think about independence as, yeah, like this peak historical event within Ireland's history. But I also just wanted to think about, you know, independence as a word in and of itself. And, you know, it can mean freedom from external control. It can mean freedom of movement. So I thought, okay, well, 100 years later, what does independence look like for women? You know, it's post-repeal, etc. But, you know, we still have this huge, like this brutal practice of silencing women constantly, as is borne out in the news all the time. So I just thought, what does independence mean for women, and what stops women from moving in the world or from moving in Ireland now? And yeah, and then this instance of forced hair cutting became an event to sort of hang those thoughts off of, I suppose.
How quickly did hair cutting, did you know that that was going to be, I suppose, the central image and the core of the story, really?
Oh, it took ages. It took ages. I wrote when Cliona sent on the brief, which, you know, was this lovely, porous, open brief. I ended up writing two other shorter pieces. And then, you know, and they're fine stories in and of themselves. I might go back to them another time, but they just weren't hitting the right mark for me, I suppose. And then I started looking more directly at primary source material around the Irish Civil War. And, you know, this the letter from Mary M to her archbishop that is getting some airtime now, where she's asking for money to help keep her son in a home because she can't admit that she became pregnant through rape during the Civil War, because the shame of the rape and the shame of the pregnancy and all of this, the son has to stay away in a home in Dublin. So, yeah, I came to it quite late. But then when, you know, then suddenly, often when it's right, it's right. And the story came together quite fluidly, thankfully, before the deadline.
Yes, and the Cliona that you're speaking about there is Cliona Ní Eolainn, who's producing this series of 12 stories. I want to listen to a clip. Now, this is quite a bit into the story. We've had some tale of, we've some part of the tale around what happened to the mother regarding an incident where she was forced into having her hair cut, basically, in a very violent and crude way. And it was all about what she was doing, possibly wearing a red skirt. Let's have a listen to that sequence. And the reader here is Saoirse Ronan.
I could tell it myself. I know it so well. And while I told her we had to listen, no matter it was something we'd heard too many times before, no matter we knew it by heart, upside down and back to front, it broke me in certain places. To know this would be one of the last things our mother would say, one of the last things her mouth would part with in the bed where she lay dying. I said, maybe she'll be asleep when we go up again. And to my shame, I wished for it. That our mother, with who we had so few hours remaining, would be asleep when we looked around the door. But of course, she was awake, our mother. An old woman wearing a nightdress with three pink flowers stitched at the collar, and another three at the hem. Our mother, who we dressed in this garment, probably intended for a child, and who lay with her hands over the duvet, resting on her stomach. Our mother's hands, with their joints so swollen, they sometimes looked like the runts of a mammal litter. Two little animals born too soon. Our mother, who started as she always started. They said I'd been seen on the road, wearing a red skirt and laughing. The red skirt, same as always. We nodded. Yes, we knew. That was what he said to her, before her eyes were even open. You were seen laughing in a red skirt.
Saoirse Ronan there, reading from Sue Rainsford's story, Shorn, and that will be broadcast in full this Sunday evening on RT Radio 1 at 7 p.m. as part of the Spoken Stories series, a 12-part series of short fiction going out at the moment on RT Radio 1. Sue, I just adore the kind of quietness that Saoirse Ronan brings to the reading. Mm. Were you involved in that side of things, or did you just hear the final product, or what way has that worked?
Well, Cleena, actually, you know, she had said we'll have a voice actor, we'll have an actor reading the piece. And I said, that's wonderful news, because it's such a lovely freedom and pleasure to have someone else read your work, I always think. But no, Cleena rang me and said that she'd approached Saoirse Ronan and she had agreed to do it. And it was, yeah, just a really, really lovely surprise. And I'm still in a bit of shock about it, to be honest.
Quite brilliant. And the tone, is that the tone you had in your mind, that kind of really calm exposition of what happened?
Yes, absolutely. Because, I mean, I think the story, it's told from the perspective of a daughter, obviously, who's, you know, she's sort of peripheral to the central trauma of the story, if you will. Like, it is her mother's trauma. But as she says in the story, she knows it back to front and upside down and left to right. And, you know, so it would have, I suppose, broken with the sensibility of the piece to have any kind of a dramatic reading or any kind of delivery full of gusto. So, no, I mean, it is just, it's the ideal reading, in my opinion. I'm delighted.
Yeah, the drama is there, but it's all very understated, and all the better for that. Mm. Lovely to speak with you this evening, Sue.
And you too, Sean.
Stay safe in Zimbabwe and hope that all goes well if you get home and get the wedding sorted in March. Good luck with all of that as well.
Yeah, we'll see. Thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you. That's Sue Rainsford there. And Spoken Stories is broadcast every Sunday evening on RTE Radio 1 at 7 p.m. The stories are also available as podcasts. Go to the website rte.ie/radio1/spoken-stories. Short documentary released this weekend called Clubbing is Culture is aiming to shine a light on the decimation of club culture in our cities, especially in Dublin. The documentary celebrates the fact that clubbing brings people together, enabling them to communicate, create and connect in unique ways. It also draws our attention to the economic importance of clubbing. And I'm joined now by one of those featured in the documentary, Philly McMahon. When we talk about decimation here, obviously there's no clubbing going on at the moment for the reasons we're all only too aware of. But I think this worry about decimation was in your mind long before we couldn't go to a nightclub because of COVID, Philly.
Absolutely, Sean. I'd probably wager that the pandemic probably offers this situation an opportunity, right? But in terms of what was happening, was that the kind of, I guess we feel like the Disneyfication of Dublin, you know, these kind of the more hotel rooms that are being built, these kind of amazing cultural spaces are being stripped away. And nightclubs, and, you know, anybody listening to your show has gone to one nightclub or another, is, you know, we all have amazing memories of these kind of grand, big spaces. And of course, in Dublin at the moment, these are being reduced, A, in number, but B, to these kind of tiny postage stamp dance floors. And so the campaign really, the message really is that we really need to kind of have a grown-up conversation about what nightlife culture is, what clubbing culture is, and what it means to people.
And was there a straw that broke the camel's back? Was there a moment in, I suppose we really would have to probably go back more than 12 months ago, when you thought there's something really harmful happening here in terms of the decimation of clubbing and clubs themselves?
I think we've all watched it on some scale, right? We've watched the city change. And, you know, Dublin seems to move in cycles, but it seems that when we're the poorer we are, the more opportunity there is for creativity to flourish. And, you know, Ireland and Dublin had its kind of clubbing heyday in the 90s. It was kind of that moment when the Celtic Tiger kind of just began to roar, but we kind of hadn't run away with ourselves.
And what are the venues? What are the venues you're talking about in that case, Philly?
I'm talking about like Pod, Red Box, Temple Theatre, Re-Raw. These kind of amazing spaces. You know, I think in one level, people have always been suspicious of nightclubs, right? It's about like, you know, what happens down there. But if I was to pitch a nightclub, if I was to tell somebody, you know, there's this amazing space where they play the, you know, the most amazing music. It's the most democratic space you'll ever be in. And, you know, young people will not only find themselves there, but they will find their tribe there and they'll create value systems there that they'll carry with them for life. And they might also make their artistic collaborators that they'll work with for life, as I did. So if I pitched the idea of a nightclub, you might go, oh my God, what is this utopia, you know? And you can get a good drink. So I just think that we have allowed the suspicion around nightclubs to kind of, to almost become kind of nanny state-ish about how we, you know, licensing laws and how it all kind of runs in the city.
When you talk about the suspicions around nightclubs there, are you talking about fears that people might have around alcohol consumption and indeed other substances, drug consumption?
Absolutely. And I think I think that we can't have a conversation about clubbing as culture without saying that parts of the clubbing culture needs to change, or that we need to have an adult conversation about consumption, about how young Irish people drink, take drugs, whatever. I'm not saying those things shouldn't happen. What I'm saying is just about how we have to take personal responsibility around those things as well. So it's a layered conversation, you know. But nightclubs in this country generally make their money and do their business for 9 hours a week, Thursday, Friday and Saturday between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. And so there's just a sense that, you know, young people are traveling to go clubbing. They're going to Berlin. They're seeing all this kind of creativity. And they're also realizing abroad that you don't have to cram excess into 3 hours in a night and have a blowout. You can, you know, enjoy the evening. Things go on later. People stagger home at different times. And of course, there's so much art and creativity, movements coming out of the dance floor. You know, this is Pop Baby, which is my theatre company. We all met on the dance floors of Dublin. We became creatives, you know, we grew those things, and now we're kind of major employers in the creative industries. They're very precious spaces to us. And of course, you know, we're not spring chickens, you know, but we are thinking about like, what are those spaces for young people? Because we created value systems there. We met people from all over the city, people that were not like us.
You say at one point in the documentary that everybody's equal on the dance floor. I might be paraphrasing slightly, but I thought it was a nice idea that, you know, when we're all out there, well, we're all the same, basically. Some of us might be better dancers than others, but that's another day's work. But the other thing that's drawn attention to in the documentary that I think it's important to speak about, Philly, is, and now this has already happened, this idea of a nighttime economy task force, but the idea that there is an economy to be tapped into and to be supported around clubbing culture.
Yeah, I think there's an amazing opportunity, right? It's unprecedented. We've shut the city down and, you know, and everything is closed. And we're about to ask the question is, how can we fuel the economy going forward? How can we help publicans? How can we help restaurants? And part of that is actually a nighttime offering. You know, there's an asset there really that we can sweat. Any Dubliners will remember, you know, the glory days of sitting in Bewley's over a cup of tea for 3 hours with a mate, you know, at 11 p.m. at night. You can't get a cup of tea in this city after 5 p.m., you know. If you work in the city, if you come out of the theatre, you've been working, you can't go and sit somewhere casual. You've got to have, these days, Dublin has become too expensive. There's a question about, like, who is the city for? And so the pandemic offers this kind of amazing opportunity to go, right,
That's what I wanted to ask you finally, Philly, which is we are at the point now where everything is closed down. So what should be happening now so that when things open back up, we can have some sort of forward movement?
Well, you know, people may not know, but there is a nighttime economy cultural task force. And that's kind of, there's a lot of stakeholders there, including the guards, city managers and that kind of thing. So this is really on people's radars. And so I think that there should be some energy behind, you know, imagining the city that we want to live in, and also imagining the city that we want young people to live in. You know, I think that we need to move offline a lot, bring people back into analog spaces where they can be together and kind of forge community.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, you've stated your case for us there. And I suppose it would help it would help, Philly, if people went and looked at the documentary. That's really what you wanted us to get out there for you this evening, I think. That's Philly McMahon. And the documentary that Philly was talking to us about is called Clubbing is Culture. Just go onto YouTube and search Clubbing is Culture and it will come up. Nice, short 20-minute view and worth a watch. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening, we'll be starting with Celeste Epiphany Wade, who just goes by the name Celeste. British singer-songwriter championed by label mate Michael Kiwanuka, amongst others, rising star awards from both the BBC and the Brit Awards. Much is expected from her debut album, Not Your Muse. Next up, Arlo Parks, another young British artist hotly tipped since her debut single, Cola, in 2019. Her music has been described as like a warm hug by NME magazine. Her debut album is called Collapsed in Sunbeams. And finally, a relative veteran with over 20 albums under her belt, American singer and songwriter Annie DeFranco continues her journey across alternative rock, folk, funk and jazz and brings us her latest release, which is called Revolutionary Love. Brian Boyd and Nadine O'Regan have been listening for us. We'll start with Celeste, Not Your Muse, the title of the album, and here's a track called Stop This Flame. You got your somebody calling, you think you're somebody, don't you? I think you're scared. Somebody close. Stop This Flame, the title of the track there from Not Your Muse debut album from Celeste, and Brian Boyd and Nadine O'Regan, our listeners on this Friday evening. Quite a splash from Celeste for a debut album, Nadine.
Yeah, and you can probably hear already why she's been compared to artists including Amy Winehouse, Billie Holiday, Norah Jones in there as well. And it's just that kind of sound, I think, that stops you in your tracks very fast. You know, she's a really beautiful phrasing, an exceptional vocal. There's a lot of kind of air in it, and how they've recorded the album, it just feels like there's a lot of space behind her. And we all know, like, obviously 2020 was so difficult for artists, but she was announced as the sound of the winner of the Sound of 2020 competition by the BBC back in January 2020. And can you imagine how terrible that would have been to have been announced as the Sound of the Year in the year that was? But actually, you know, they delayed the album, and that was a good thing because I think it gave her a bit more of a chance to finesse even further these songs.
Yeah, and Nadine mentioning there, Brian, Amy Winehouse, Billie Holiday, Norah Jones, and indeed you had mentioned, Nadine, in your notes, the Adele comparisons, particularly on the track we just heard, Stop This Flame. All of those comparisons are great, but does she manage, Brian, do you think, to plough her own furrow, if you know what I mean? Does she separate herself from those wonderful vocal artists? But you want to be yourself as well, don't you?
You do, and it's very hard to, I mean, for a singer with a debut album, and people are talking about, I was reading the reviews, I mean, Nina Simone, Aretha Franklin, Eartha Kitt, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, I mean, for God's sake, give the woman a break. This is her debut album. But she did, she cleaned up all these Best Newcomer Awards. The last person to do that was Adele. And you do get a sense, as great as this album is, and it's a very good album, you do get a sense that there's a lot of people involved. I noticed there was like five songwriters on some of the tracks. That's like Battery Farm songwriters. Mm. The producer in this album has also worked with Pink and Shakira. You'll be hearing all of these songs could conceivably be used on TV ads over the next few months. There's a people with the same situation with Adele. A lot of people went all in on this person, and you get the sense with this album that it's the production is so smooth. I listened to her. She had an EP 2 years ago called Lately, and I listened to that again today. It's a very different singer. You know,
a better singer.
It was rougher. It was the sound we're getting now is she's been sanded down, but it's very, very impressive. But I do think I just balk a bit at the fact that you have five songwriters. It's Battery Farm songwriting.
What about
territory.
That? Well, what about that, Nadine?
Well, to be fair, there's only five songwriters on one track on the record. I mean, there's 12 songs, and on the other songs, she's listed as the lead songwriter on every single song. And in the majority of songs, there's either two songwriters, including herself, or three. And I do think, now, I did think about this, to be fair, I did think about this issue, because you can hear as you go through the tracks that there's a cohesiveness there that has come from that process, maybe of being sanded down slightly and having a lot of record company interests in the success of this album. You can tell certainly that there is a weight of expectation and a great hope that she could become the next Adele. But I do think that, you know, the fact that she's listed as the primary songwriter on every track is important.
Is noteworthy.
And I think as well, she is a little, you know, she's naturally quite melancholic and naturally, like, she was on the Graham Norton show recently and I thought she looked a bit, you know, nervy in the spotlight. Adele is a very different kind of performer, and I think a lot of people would say about her that she does such a tremendous interview. She's such a lovable person that her kind of star power comes from her vocal, of course, but also from her personality. So I think Celeste will be a very different kind of star.
Well, let's have a listen to a track that maybe gives us a quieter side rather than the big Adele kind of ballads that we might be used to. This is a track called Strange.
Isn't it strange? I am still me, you are still you, in the same place.
Doubting the quality of that vocal, I think. Strange from Celeste and her debut album, Not Your Music. Brian, the version I got was a deluxe version, and it had 12 tracks on, if you like, the first album, and there was then 9 tracks as the kind of add-on as the second album. I was so satisfied with the 12 tracks. It was an album as opposed to 12 separate songs. Did you not think it was crafted together well in that respect?
Very well. And what impressed me about it was, I mean, what we just heard there was this exquisite Beehive Torch song. But she's also very good. She's on some of the songs, she conjures up this big band era. Mm. Other songs could have come from the jazz swing. Other songs would sound very much at home in a nightclub, in a super club in Ibiza. And that's the great range she has. And the way she... What impressed me most, I mean, she obviously has a very, very strong voice, but she softens it and she modulates it according to the dynamics and the melody.
Yeah.
Very, very well put together, very, very talented.
All right. Stars then from you, Brian?
3.5.
3.5. And from you, Nadine?
He nearly said 4. I'm going to go 4.
You're going 4. It's a bit cold for the 4 yet. Still January. We might get a 4 from Brian a little bit later in the year. 3.5 and 4 respectively there for Celeste and Not Your Music. Second artist this evening, Arlo Parks. Nadine, maybe you would give me a little bit of her background. It's not exactly the same as Celeste, but she's in a kind of a similar stable.
Yeah, not dissimilar, certainly. She has kind of an international background, similar to Celeste, who was born in the States, but largely grew up in Brighton from around the age of 3 or 4. Parks, who's only 20 now, she was born in Paris. Her father's Nigerian, her mother is French, and she grew up in London, and from a very young age was really as interested in poetry as she was in writing songs. She's hugely inspired by the likes of Joan Didion. She's been reading Nabokov. And really, actually, when it comes to her debut, the lyrics are as important, if not more important, than the music.
Yeah,
she's a real observational take on life.
Yeah, the album is called Collapse and Sunbeams, and the opening track is a spoken word track. It's really a poem with a musical accompaniment. But then the singing starts on track 2, which is called Hurt.
Lovely to feel something for once.
There we go. That That's a track called Hurt from Arlo Parks, and her debut album Collapsed in Sunbeams. Wouldn't it be lovely to feel something for once, she says in the chorus of that song, Brian Boyd. And also she's telling this story of a young man called Charlie. She's an advocate for a mental health charity called CAM, Campaign Against Living Miserably. She manages to get, to my mind, do you agree, that she gets that in there without beating you over the head with some kind of campaign?
True. It's very much sad girl in her bedroom music, but this is Arlo is a sad girl who's reading the poetry of Sylvia Plath and listening to the music of Joni Mitchell. She's a fantastic poetic feel. Some of the songs, you mentioned. She does talk about depression. She very much, these are narrative rich short stories for the Instagram generation, and she does talk about mental health issues. But as you said, she's more or less reflecting her own experiences and those of her friends. And I think the great thing is she's just got such an observant ear and eye. Some of the songs she's talking about, she overhears an argument between two arty people at a bus stop. Nobody else would think of that a song. It's so fresh, it's organic. She's only 20, Sean. And if you think that a person is 20, she only has her adolescence to draw on, but there's no sense of melodrama, there's no sense of heightened emotion. You just get this very beautiful view of the world from her point of view. Yeah, and apparently she's been writing poems since she was four. That's how she makes sense of her world.
Yeah, she has diaries and notebooks that she uses. Mm. And Nadine, Brian mentioning there, the quality of the lyrics and the variety of the lyrics across the songs. What about the variety of the music across the songs? It did strike me that while it was very impressive, there was a similarity across the 11 tracks.
Yeah, there is a similarity, and it gets problematic after a time because you start to long for more of a sense of development within the tracks themselves. There's very little in terms of dynamism. She kind of gets into a theme and then goes with it and repeats it. It's verse, chorus, verse, and off she goes. So the music is, you heard there, they're kind of jazzy, mellow, there's some sort of looped break beats. I actually found the more, trip-hoppy ones a little bit more interesting than some of the others, because I felt that there was, just maybe a more interesting kind of dimension. But generally speaking, I feel like you're going to listen to her for her words more than you are for the music. And that for me was a little disappointing.
All right, let's have a listen to a track called Eugene. Hey. The title of that track there from Arlo Parks and her debut album Collapsed in Sunbeams. Are you excited as to where she might go after this, Brian, or has she really put down a marker with album number one?
Very much. I just love her idiosyncratic view of the world and the stories she tells. And just come back to the music thing. She's conjuring up a musical mood just really to carry the lyrics. So the guitar sounds, the acoustic guitars are strummed, the drums are brushed, and you just get these light glosses of synth just caressing the songs. That's all that's needed, because when you have this sort of vision, and she really does have this remarkable way of describing her immediate environment, you don't want any sort of sophisticated electronic bells and whistles going on in the background. Right. So I think the music suits it perfectly.
It's the Leonard Cohen argument, isn't it? Who reviews a Leonard Cohen album for the music?
True. Yeah, I did think, as Brian was saying it there, right enough, I don't mean this pejoratively, it's a step up from spoken word in that it's just about in the area of singing and music, but there is, the poetry is very much what's driving the album itself. So Stars for me. I'll go first to you, actually, Nadine, on this one. Stars.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I think she's fantastically talented. 3.5 stars.
3.5 from you. And Brian?
She reminded me very much of Martina Topley-Bird and Sharon Nelson from Massive Attack. 4.
4. So it's the other way around this time for Arlo Parks and Collapse and Sunbeams. 3.5 and 4 again, but the 4 coming from Brian this time. Let's move on to our final album from this evening, Revolutionary Love, from Annie DeFranco, around a little bit longer than either Celeste or Arlo Parks. Let's have a listen to a track called Do or Die.
Cause there's foxes in the hen house, and bad news Pennsylvania Avenue, the sheetless KKK. And there's models wielding microphones, chasing maniacs around. And everything's on fire. And there's twisters touching down.
Do or Die, the title of that track there from the album Revolutionary Love from Annie DeFranco. This is, Nadine, recorded almost entirely over just 2 days and released on DeFranco's own Righteous Babe album. Now, recording something over 2 days can be a really brilliant thing or a really awful thing. Which which camp are you in on this one?
Well, actually, to be honest, somewhere in between. You know, I've kind of followed Annie DeFranco's career over the years. And, you know, back in the kind of early 2000s, late 1990s, she was that kind of fire starter in terms of a singer-songwriter and used to write sort of songs that were very heavy on the percussive guitar. And there was a lot of yelling here and there. And if you were into sort of Alanis Morissette or that kind of style of music, a lot of people would have followed her career trajectory. And to be honest, a few albums in, I just got a bit tired of that kind of sound from her. It felt a bit overwhelmingly about her as opposed to about the music. So what I quite liked about this album was that it felt a bit fuller and rounder and jazzier and more mellow, more low-key. It felt like she was almost tapping into her Van Morrison sort of sensibility. Right. Now, she's 22 albums in, though, having said that. So there's, to some extent, does she have something new to say? Maybe not particularly, but it was a pleasant listen.
All right. Brian Boyd, you are making comparisons here with Samuel Beckett and Waiting for Godot, but don't get too excited about that comparison just yet.
There's 11 songs on this album. You know, the famous early review of Beckett's Waiting for Godot was nothing happens twice. On this album, nothing happens 11 times. It's banal elevator jazz music with trite cliches about peace and love. And she's talking about, you know, we can transform the world through the healing power of love. Oh, give it a rest, Annie, really.
You're on the fence about this one then, Brian, are you?
It's an appalling album, and 2 days is actually an insult. She's not trying. She's just, there's just cliches. If we all love each other, the world would be a better place. No thanks, Annie. No thank you.
Nadine.
Oh, come on. He's being very harsh. I think it's just difficult when you have established a career for yourself as kind of a firebrand, you know, always probing into, I suppose, establishment elements with your lyrics. And then over time, things change and you mellow. And this is a mellow record. And maybe for her previous fans, they're just not going to get with it. All but right. Like, is it capable? Is it well executed? I think it is.
Stars, Nadine.
I will go 3.
3. And how many stars for something not happening 11 times, Brian?
None.
None? No. Seriously? 0?
No.
That bad?
That really is that bad. It's awful.
Well, there you go. That's your Friday night off to a nice start if you're an Annie DeFranco fan. Brian Boyd and Nadine O'Regan. Annie DeFranco's Revolutionary Love with a revolutionary score. Arlo Parks Collapsed in Sunbeams. And Celeste, the album actually is Not Your Muse. I think I may have misnamed it along the way. Not Your Muse is the title of the Celeste album. Thanks to Brian and Nadine for that. That is our lot for this Friday evening. Indeed, for this week, Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Anne-Marie Donlan was the broadcast coordinator this evening. Sound supervision was by Gara Duffy. Tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan.